I know reunions are fun, but the Health and Human Services Committee will come to order. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Fine.
Here.
Representatives Barrero.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Skidmore.
Here.
Amnesty.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
Cross.
Here.
Dunkley, excuse. Edmonds.
Present.
Grant. Hart.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Masula.
Here.
Persons Mulica.
Here.
Flakin.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Trabuzzi.
Here.
Tuck.
Here.
Woodson.
Here.
Yurkowski.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Sabrina. As we begin, I ask everyone to silence your cell phones. We do have a presentation today, but before we get to that, I would like to share some changes that have been made on the committee, introduce a few new people. First off, I want to introduce our new vice chair, Representative Barrero. Representative Barrero did an extraordinary job. If you saw Speaker Clemens' final committee hearing last session, it was sort of a miracle to watch. And so I was really excited to see you come on up here, and we'll get you ready to sit in one of these chairs fairly soon. So welcome to the vice chair.
Thank you very much, Chairman Fine, and thanks for the positive remarks, and thank you to Speaker Renner for allowing me to serve as vice chair. I look forward to working with each one of you on the committee.
Thank you. We also have a new committee whip. Where is he, Representative Anderson? Where are you sitting? So he scares me, so I thought that he would be a good person to whip everyone. So we're happy to have you, and welcome as whip.
Thank you, Chair. It's an honor to serve on this committee last session, and an absolute privilege to work with you, Chair, and the rest of the healthcare team.
Thank you. Speaking of people who scare me, Representative Salzman, we promoted out of being whip, and she is going to now chair the Health Regulation Committee, which Speaker Clemens chaired last session, and congratulations on that, and we're happy to have you in that role, if you want to say anything.
I just want to say that Anderson's got some big shoes to fill.
That he does.
Thank you.
You scare me more than him. So, and then finally, I want to introduce Representative Tuck, who's going to chair the Select Committee on Health Innovation. She's new to the committee, and so now I can say there's someone who knows less about healthcare than I do. And so, so welcome to the role, and we're very happy to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here. I'm just glad I don't scare you, Chairman Fine. So it's good stuff.
Well, I do have three women as my sub-chairs now, so I'm going to always be scared. Finally, we have a new Democratic member on our committee, Representative Hart, and we want to welcome you to sit to the committee as well.
Thank you, and I look forward to working on the healthcare committee. I am definitely interested in healthcare, so it's a real pleasure to be with all of you all. Look forward to adding something positive.
Good. Well, thank you for being here. So with that out of the way, we're going to move into our presentation for today. If we need the whole 90 minutes, we'll take it. If we don't, that's going to be okay too. Members, today we're joined by representatives of the vast majority of hospitals in Florida. I thought that, you know, as we think about a lot of healthcare issues, hospitals are obviously an important part of the mix. Sometimes they get treated well, sometimes they don't. It's one of those things that you only think about when you get hurt and you're on the way the emergency room. I wanted them to come in and sort of share how they operate, in part because there are different business models that our hospitals operate in the state. They don't all work the same. And so understanding that, it's not one size doesn't fit all. So today we've got Michael Williams, the general counsel for the Florida Hospital Association, and Justin Senior, CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. They're going to talk about the four general models of hospital corporate structures that we have in Florida. Members, I'm going to ask us to hold questions until the end of presentations, but we don't have any bills or anything else, so we should have plenty of time. Mr. Williams, would you like to start? You are recognized.
Sure. All right, so good morning. My name is Michael Williams. I'm the General Counsel of the Florida Hospital Association. I'd like to thank Chair Fine, as well as the members of the Health and Human Service Committee, for inviting me to present today on behalf of Florida's more than 200 hospital and health system members. FHA represents generally each of the hospital types we're going to talk about today, including substantially all of the publics, save for two, and then a majority of the not-for-profit hospitals. as a base here, I just want to start out with every hospital and health system in this state provides valuable and vital services to the patients and communities we serve. Those services range from urgent and highly specialized care delivered not only in the inpatient setting, but there are many programs and services delivered throughout the communities to advance health and wellness. Hospitals provide financial assistance to those in need of help, subsidies for services that would otherwise be unavailable, such as burn or neonatal units, transportation, food assistance, training for the next generation of caregivers, and vital research to aid in the treatment of longstanding diseases such as cancer. Each hospital seeks to achieve an optimal care experience for their patients by focusing on a number of domains. We've got them on the slide here for you, but the goal is, by successfully doing this, we're going to attract new residents and tourists to Florida by prioritizing timely, efficient, high-quality, modern, effective cost health care. So a brief overview of Florida's hospitals. We have 320 hospitals, 71,000 beds. That number, 228 service community acute care hospitals. That includes your teaching hospitals, your rural clinics, children's hospitals, trauma centers. There are also behavioral and rehab hospitals in the states and long-term care. Florida's hospitals have served as an economic driver for their communities. A study by the University of Florida attributes hospitals $177.76 billion in annual economic output. This includes $81 billion in wages and benefits and nearly $23 billion in tax revenue and local government support. 1 in 10 jobs in the state of Florida are tied to hospitals, and Florida hospitals directly employ almost 300,000 full-time employees. Our hospitals treat more than 10 million ER visits, 2.5 million inpatient admissions, and deliver 216,500 births. Before I get into the different ownership structures, I want to emphasize that hospitals largely function under the same regulatory requirements. The slide in front of you, you'll note that there are many. You're mostly looking at our federal agencies. The number is, frankly, dizzying. CMS is our primary regulator, but within the Department of Health and Human Services, there are other agencies. The Health Resource Services Administration is involved in workforce development, rural health policy, telehealth, and they oversee the critical 340B drug pricing program. Office of National Coordinator and Health IT manages privacy and security programs like HIPAA. ASPR oversees emergency preparedness, SAMHSA behavioral health, and so on. Hospitals with cancer programs often are regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, part of the Department of Energy. All hospitals, like any other employer, are subject to the laws and rules of OSHA and the EEOC, and there are specific OSHA rules that apply to hospitals like PPE, respiratory protection requirements, and so forth. All hospitals are also subject to the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, which ensures access to emergency medical services, regardless of an individual's ability to pay. And I want to emphasize all of these rules and regulations apply to any hospital, regardless of their ownership structure. There are also state agencies we work with. I'd be remiss not to mention ACA, DCF, DOH, the Board of Pharmacy, the Division of Emergency Management, and others. The main regulatory structure for hospitals is going to be found in your Medicare conditions of participation, a series of qualifications developed by CMS that hospitals and others must meet to participate in Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP. Those are the generally largest payers for our hospitals. Conditions of participation focus on health and safety guidelines to protect patients, include mandatory quality assessments and performance improvement programs, ensure hospitals have organized medical staff to ensure quality of care, and different services like surgery, emergency care, respiratory care also have their own COPs. Again, hospitals, even though they're different, essentially have the same regulatory structure they've got to work within. So what are our four corporate structures we're going to talk about today? There's for-profit hospitals, government hospitals, and we're going to spend a bit more time on public and nonprofit hospitals because they tend to be under a more unique reporting and regulatory standard. So the state has 160 total for-profit hospitals. Got a traditional governance structure that you might find in a state corporation act. For-profit hospitals can be publicly traded. You know, in this state, that would include Tenet and HCA. It's also a private equity presence. It's really kind of grown up in the last 20 years or so. In Florida, we don't have a ton of private equity hospitals, but I believe there's a total of 9 at the moment. You know, those for-profit or those publicly traded hospitals are regulated by SEC rules. There's also obviously reporting requirements within private equity too. And so there is a reporting and regulatory burden associated with those hospitals. They provide care for patients across the state under the same quality standards. And they do provide benefits to their communities. You know, you'll see charitable contributions, especially from those for-profit hospitals. And they're also obviously required to abide by those EMTALA regulations that require them to treat anybody regardless of their ability to pay. Government-owned hospitals, this is, you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. You've got federal and state hospitals, VA at the federal level. State level, we're generally talking about mental health facilities. I think that's really, you know, if we want to talk more about those, we can, but I'm going to move on from there. So public hospitals. So you're talking about special districts, unit of government created for a particular purpose. You've got two classifications there, independent and dependent. These special hospitals were created under statute, generally because that local governing body determined that there are healthcare services that our counties need that are not being met currently. You know, those might include trauma centers, might include RIPICs, which deals with prenatal care, and any other sort of, you know, transplant, you know, what it may be. They're organized because their local municipality reviewed what they had available and determined they needed to create a special hospital district. Those hospital districts generally, and the authorities granted to them, include building hospitals, exercising eminent domain, can issue bonds, utilize ad valorem taxes for operations and maintenance. It's not an exhaustive list, nor is it applicable to all hospital districts. Some have the ability to tax, others don't. A dependent hospital district is a special district, and I'm going to kind of read off a long list here, so excuse me, where the membership of the governing body is either identical to the governing body of a single county. All members of the governing body are appointed by the governing body or a single county. Members of the district's governing body are removable at will by the governing body of a single county or municipality, or the district's budget is subject to the approval of the governing body and municipality. An independent district is a special district that does not meet any of those qualifications or characteristics. So the boards of an independent district generally are appointed or developed in three ways. One is a general election, one is a governor appointment, and the other is some combination of a appointment with ratification by the county's governing body. This slide just gives you a list of all the hospitals and healthcare districts in the state. Within the independent category, I mentioned FHA counts all but two among our membership. You'll find hospitals of all kind within this list. You have small rural hospitals, all the way up to large teaching medical centers, research centers, and so forth. There are two major sections of the Florida statutes that govern these independent and special districts. 189 is the state statute that governs all independent or all special districts. There's more than 1,800 in Florida, ranging from housing and community development to the hospital districts we're talking about today. Section 155 of the Florida statutes applies specifically to hospitals, and section 154 discusses public health facilities. 155 includes information on mergers or sale of public hospitals. There are also opportunities for public hospitals to convert from a public to a not-for-profit status. Not-for-profit hospitals, I'm going to skip some of these, are regulated by Florida's not-for-profit corporation statute, as well as the IRS's section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code. Not-for-profit hospitals are managed by boards. The state requires at least 3 members of board. Generally, a hospital board is going to be larger than that. And like any other not-for-profit corporation, the revenue generated by those hospitals may not benefit a private interest like an individual or private shareholders. Not-for-profit corporations submit annual reports to the state. They identify basic business concerns, such as address, a list of registered officers. names of registered agents, and the date of incorporation. The IRS also has significant reporting requirements to ensure not-for-profits are meeting their community benefit requirements necessary to maintain their status. This includes reporting the amount spent on community benefits yearly and conducting a community health needs assessment every 3 years. Community benefit reports don't just include debt write-offs or charity care. They also factor in community improvement. We talked about some of that earlier, you know, the food banks, the education of healthcare providers, and so forth. And that three-year assessment is something of a strategic plan for those hospitals. They're expected then to implement their plan to improve their community health status. The IRS also requires not-for-profit hospitals to develop financial assistance programs. We have 167 of those in the state. This slide mostly reiterates what I just said. FHA periodically develops a community benefit report. This includes both our public members as well as our not-for-profit members. The not-for-profit members, we pull information from the IRS 990 form. It's called Section H. Section H requires the reporting of all the community benefit offered, including those community improvement products, bad debt, the Medicaid shortfall, charity care provided. In 2019, this is our 2020 report, in 2019, our hospitals provided $4.9 billion in community benefit. Of that, $3.9 billion was free care for low-income patients. And again, this is both public hospitals and not-for-profit hospitals. Those benefits represented 13.7% of a hospital's operating expenses. So it's a significant amount, 8% or so of hospital expenses are returned to the community. There's $642 million on community health improvement and then $390 million in costs associated with healthcare, professional education, workforce development, and research. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll thank you again for your time.
Thank you, and I'm sure people have a lot of questions that they want to ask, but I think before we do that, I'd like to have our other presentation come up here. So these guys represented all the hospitals. Now Justin's going to talk about a subset of those hospitals that his organization represents. Mr. Senior, you are recognized.
Okay, thank you. I don't know where my presentation is. I am from the...
Give us 1 second. It's loaded in the computer. If you just close this one and open yours, it should be down there somewhere. No, it wouldn't. You'd have to close that, yeah. And, okay, someone's coming. There we go. Push that little button down there in the bottom right that makes it take up the whole screen.
Right.
One more. It's next to the little sliding thing. No. Up. All right, go left. A little more. There it is. There it is, right there. There you go.
Okay. Sorry.
Now go back to the start.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you. Hope I get.
I do tech support as well.
My name is Justin Senior. I'm the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. Our members are 14 hospital systems. They're comprised of public hospitals, academic medical centers, children's hospitals, and something called a regional perinatal intensive care center hospital. Our hospitals run from Pensacola down to Miami and pretty much everywhere in between. And our hospitals are all not-for-profit, whether they're public or private. They take all patients, regardless of ability to pay, and we tend to be located in areas where there is low-income access for the communities that we serve. As nonprofits, we have a public mission as well as a mission to teach. So what you're going to see in our hospitals is you're going to see that we run lines of business that other hospitals won't because the margins are too low or the margins are negative. And we also tend to maintain expensive, low-volume units that are at the ready at all times for the benefit of public health. What you see here is simply an illustration of the fact that we see a lot more than our quote-unquote fair share of Medicaid patients, as well as our fair share of patients who are uninsured or unable to pay. We're only about 28% of the total days in the state of Florida in terms of hospital days and stays by patients. And yet we're generally at any given year about 40%. We see 40% of the Medicaid patients and nearly half of the charity care. I'll tell you also some of the things, and I'm going to be brief so I can answer your questions, but some of the things that you should expect to see from a public hospital or from an academic medical center. You're generally going to see our hospitals do a higher charity care percentage, more charity care patients than other hospitals in the area. You're generally going to see us handle higher Medicaid patient loads. It wouldn't be unusual for some of our big hospitals to have a third of the patients or maybe more come through would be Medicaid or uninsured. And we even have some members where 60 to 70% of the patients who come through are Medicaid or uninsured. And that does have an impact because Medicaid tends to pay lower than Medicare as well as pay lower than commercial. And so it does put some pressure on our hospitals. We tend to, as a result of that, have lower margins than other hospitals in the industry. The other thing you can expect to see, though, is we're going to be maintaining units that have low margin or no margin that are really high cost. And so what you would see in our facilities are a lot of transplant units, a lot of the burn centers. You'd see these advanced neonatal intensive care center hospitals. A RIPIC, the Regional Perinatal Intensive Care Center Hospital, is kind of a regional center of excellence that helps moms that are having difficult pregnancies. So it's got kind of an advanced OBGYN unit and an advanced neonatal intensive care unit in one for high-risk pregnancies. And almost all of the RIPICs in the state are members of our group. We also are going to have, not even on this chart, Baker Act receiving facilities and things like that, some of the low-volume stuff that none of the other hospitals or most other hospitals aren't willing to do. We also run a huge percentage of the level one trauma centers. And to do this is a real high expense because you have to have about 20 to 25 specialists and subspecialists at the ready and available every day, all day, for anyone who walks in the door. And you don't really know who's going to come in the door that needs a trauma treatment, whether it's going to be a member of Elon Musk's family or whether it's going to be a Medicaid family or an uninsured family, but it has to be ready for everyone in the region. I will say also the other thing that we expect and our members expect is that as we do these things and it does tighten our margins, there should be no compromise on quality. If you look at the state of Florida's safety net hospitals and the members of our group, you will see that we tend to be all over the U.S. News and World Report rankings in the state of Florida as the top hospitals in the state. We do very well on the CMS star quality ratings, and it's really important that the families that come into our facility get world-class care, and every one of our facilities is very committed to that. We also are, and we see ourselves as real economic engines in the state of Florida. The FHA, Mike mentioned that, how important hospitals are. But as we have people moving in, 1,000 people a day moving to the state of Florida, there's an expectation when they get here that there be world-class healthcare. And all of the hospitals in the state, there's no one here representing the for-profits, but all of us together, the hospital industry in the state of Florida is very high quality. If you look at the outcomes in the state of Florida, the for-profits, our members, the FHA members together, deliver really solid outcomes that compare favorably to almost every other state in the nation. And so we're very proud of that. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. And we may have a lot. I'm going to ask a few just sort of high-level questions to help out. Mr. Williams, I think they may be for you. So just to start. So from a numbers perspective, that's fine, stay there. From a numbers perspective, you said there were 164 profits. You said there were 167 nonprofits. How many government are there? That was the one we just didn't get a number on, just so people can set the table. 160, 167, and
by government, you mean public? Yes, sir.
Owned by the government?
25, I believe, independent, plus another 5 special, and I might be off, or a dependent, I might be off one number either way. But
okay. So there's 30 districts.
That's
some
right.
of them might not have hospitals, and some of them might have more than one, but you know, sort of
that's
somewhere
right.
in the 30-ish. Number, so, and that's a number we'll follow up,
yes, sir.
And we'll get so people know. And then in your analysis of nonprofit, for-profit, government, where do university either of you where do university hospitals get? Cause to me, it's one thing if it's like you know a special district created by the government, but I don't think of the UF hospital would sort of be a different. Theoretically, it's owned by the government. So is that categorized as one of these special districts, or is that a nonprofit or a for-profit, where would university hospitals go?
So, and may I respond?
Yes, you're right.
So, As I understand some of these universities, there are two corporate structures. One is the hospital structure and one is the actual education structure. And so I believe those hospitals would be part of that not-for-profit. And I can get you more specifics on
that. Shands, I think that's right. I'm confirming because I don't think they're part of this. I think they're part of, yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Shands is a private not-for-profit.
Okay.
And it is affiliated with a public state university.
Right. So what we think of as our university hospitals are actually not owned by the government. They're actually nonprofits.
So there's a couple of different relationships, kind of the two of the big ones. It's interesting, they're almost the reverse of each other. In Miami, the hospital itself is the public health trust formed in Miami-Dade County, and it's affiliated with the University of Miami, which is a private university. In the northern part of the state, we have the FLIP, which is a private not-for-profit hospital affiliated with a public university.
Okay. The important thing for people to know is just because it's a university hospital doesn't mean it's a government hospital. I think since they have the government's name in them. And this is just for the health of the system overall. So, and you don't have this in there, but if I were to look back last year, if I lumped them all together, do you know what like the total hospital revenues in the state were and total hospital profitability, which I would define as, you know, profits plus excess, you know, how much are they? Are they making money? Are they losing money? Are they breaking even? I mean, sort of just general, what's the sort of overall state of health of the hospital system?
If I may, Mr. Chairman. Yep. Yeah, I would say that the overall state of health of the hospital system is very strong. I think that's a really good asset for the state of Florida. I don't think anybody wants any significant systems that are having or that are in crisis. So that is definitely something very good. The different types you're going to see have different margins. As a general rule, I think in the aggregate, the public hospitals are probably slightly negative when it comes to their operating margin, but not all of them are negative in any given year. And then the not-for-profit hospitals would have higher margins than that, and the for-profit hospitals would have the highest margins of all. Again, I think that having a healthy margin is actually very important to the state of Florida, and we certainly don't begrudge the profit margins at any of the other facilities. I think that that's good that they're strong, and everyone kind of pulls in the same direction when it comes to public health.
There's also no incentive to have profits if you're not-for-profit or a government-owned, but yes.
I was just going to add on to what Mr. Senior said. So an analysis done by FHA, the state margin as a whole is down approximately 66%, still a positive margin at about 2.7%, but those margins are critical in us being able to maintain our operations, especially during times of crisis, especially during times of massive inflation. Whether it be supplies, drugs, or, you know, as we've experienced over the last few years, the cost of labor and employment. So
two more, and then I'm going to open it up. Again, I'm sure these are quick. So thinking about the three types and paying taxes, taxes on your profits or taxes on your property, I presume the for-profit hospitals pay those, and the not-for-profit and the government hospitals do not. Is that one difference between them?
Mr. Chairman... So the for-profit hospitals would pay, for example, corporate income taxes potentially in the state of Florida that the not-for-profit and the public hospitals would not. All hospitals pay something called into something called the Public Medical Assistance Trust Fund. That's a percentage of their revenue. I think it's 1.5% of the inpatient revenue and 1% of the outpatient revenue. Raises between $800 million and $1 billion per year, which could then be used as the federal match in the Medicaid program. So all hospitals pay that at the local level. Nonprofits would also pay potentially local assessments that help pay for the directed payment program. So everyone pays. On the public hospital front, they have access to something called IGT. So our members fund substantially something called the low income pool, as well as a lot of graduate medical education programs that all hospitals potentially can benefit from, all the hospitals that do the work. So there is contribution being made, and there is that 1.5% and 1% being paid by all hospitals, but you're correct that the for-profits are the ones that pay the corporate income taxes.
Okay, that's all my questions for now, just some high-level questions. If you have questions, look down at me so I can put you on a list, but I know Representative Woodson, you've got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your presentation as well. I have a few questions, Mr. Chair.
That's fine, you can ask.
Thank you. The first one has to do with for-profit and then non-profit hospital. And it has to do with charitable contributions, which can come in the form of serving our indigent population, also Medicaid patients. I understand for for-profit, charitable contribution can be written off. How about the non-profit ones? Can they also write it off, or can they not?
You're recognized.
So that is correct, that the for-profits can write off their charitable contributions. The concept of the write-off here for the not-for-profit is a bit, you know, getting into the tax weeds, but there would need to be no write-off because they don't pay the taxes, generally speaking. Now, they produce, they may produce non-taxable or taxable income, which is unrelated to their business income, in which case you might cross those write-offs together, but generally speaking, there's not a purpose for a write-off here.
I want some more clarification. Mr. Chair, thank you. So the nonprofit don't have the tax write-off that the for-profit has. Is that correct?
You're recognized.
The nonprofits don't pay the taxes in the first place, and the reason they don't is they put together a community benefit report based on their charitable and their educational benefit to the community that gives them their nonprofit status and that they use to maintain their nonprofit status. So they ultimately do show these things. I mean, you can go into their community benefit report and you can see the amount of charity that they do, but as nonprofits, they are tax exempt, and so it's technically not a write-off.
And I must...
Then let me just throw some out the clever, and this is not talking about hospitals in general, but unfortunately in this country, one of the big misnomers of nonprofit, it sort of implies don't make money. I encourage you while you're sitting here, Google how much the CEO of Goodwill, a nonprofit, gets made. I think last time I looked, it was like $45 million a year. It simply means that it is an entity that doesn't have private shareholders and doesn't pay corporate income taxes. It actually can be what we all would think of as profitable. It could actually be quite profitable. And I'm not taking a shot at it. It is what it is. But a nonprofit, they don't pay corporate taxes, and they also don't pay property taxes. So that hospital, land, or whatever is not paying taxes. But, you know, if they have extra money laying around, they end up distributing it in other ways. I'm not saying hospitals do this, but obviously Goodwill pays their CEO a lot of money. And so there are ways that they distribute what we as regular people would think of as profits. Yeah. If you want to,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm asking for a reason.
Okay.
Yeah. I think your explanation is fair. They do tend to have positive operating margins. If you don't have a positive operating margin, you're not going to be in business for very long. So ultimately, they do try to maintain positive operating margins, and the not-for-profits do have that, and they try to fold and reinvest that margin, any margin that they have, into the community, which is shown on the community benefits report.
And if you, go ahead. If that didn't answer your question, please keep going.
I have another question to Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. For, in light of the disenrollment, the winding off that we do having on our Medicaid patients, the Medicaid and those who are not insured now, the nonprofit hospital, and I'm looking at the list of the safety net hospital, and some of them I have firsthand knowledge of them because I have visited them and see how many of those Medicaid patients that they see or people who are uninsured, like Memorial, for example, Jackson Hospitals, Mount Sinai. I know all these hospitals. I've visited the emergency room, and I've seen how many people they serve. How are you ready to take on those additional patients that will be coming up that are taken out of Medicaid, which means we are going to see a surge in the hospital's emergency room of those patients who will be coming with our insurance.
Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Yeah, our hospitals will be ready. We take patients regardless of their ability to pay, and we've been watching that very, very closely to see how that impacts our operations. So far, thankfully, we have not seen any major disruptions in any of our operations. Our hospitals are actually themselves eligibility points. So if someone has been dropped from Medicaid and they come into one of our hospitals, we actually can sign them back up if that was an erroneous disenrollment, and we can get them back enrolled in the program. If they don't have insurance, then we will treat them anyway. We treat them regardless of their ability to pay. And we have to watch and see how that's going to affect our bottom line, but it's very early yet to have an understanding of the impact. I will say it seems like some of the disenrollments have been healthier people so far, and that the acuity levels of some of the patients that are left in the health plans, the Medicaid health plans, have gone up. And so we haven't necessarily seen a big surge at our hospitals. So hopefully that holds. And that's kind of, we're in a watching pattern. We're watching that very closely, as I'm sure you are.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. You're recognized as well. If you want to jump in, sure.
And so, you know, largely, you know, I would echo what Mr. Senior says about their membership, which is part and parcel of our membership as well. Those hospitals that we represent in the nonprofit space that are not members of the safety net, you know, again, are held to a community benefit standard required by the IRS. They're required to have charity care policies. And so, you know, we have hospitals that are won't charge patients for up to 250% of the federal poverty level. Others may be higher than that, some lower, but the hospitals are prepared. The reason we talk about the importance of margins is so when there are shocks to the system, like a major Medicaid disenrollment, there will be ways for our hospitals to manage the needs of the community and state.
Thank you. And my last one.
For now.
Yeah, thank you. I know that you take the patients because I know Memorial, they never turn anybody away, Jackson, and they provide excellent care. Wouldn't that be some additional burden cost-wise on the hospital for those that will be coming? That's where I was going with the question.
Mr. Chairman?
You're recognized.
Yeah, we do expect that there will be some additional burden, and it will potentially be a drag on our margins. So we are watching it closely to see the exact scope of that. So far, I do think where there's been some relief, at least for the first few months, it has not been as bad as feared. And we're watching very closely in the coming months to see how it all shakes out, because I think we're still going to see some disenrollments over the coming months as the Department of Children and Families kind of works through with the Medicaid population and their eligibility status.
Okay, Representative Grant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's a follow-up to Representative Woodson. The program that was put in place by the feds when COVID hit was to allow those basically working-age people to have that coverage. So was there a drag on your operating profits prior to that program going into effect? And if so, what was it? I have a follow-up.
You're recognized.
Yeah, I think it's fair to call we're going back to status quo ante. I will say that the COVID population, by and large, is interesting. Medicaid did end up with swollen enrollment, so to speak, much larger than normal. The COVID phenomenon was a Medicare phenomenon, by and large. I mean, a huge bulk of the patients ended up being Medicare and 65 and over. And then we did have a lot more eligibility that was in the Medicaid program as a result and part of the response. Thankfully, you know, most Medicaid enrollees are children. There were not a high level of hospitalizations of children in the state or around the country, which was a fortunate thing, but not necessarily a known at the time that COVID hit. These people become eligible for Medicaid, and then it gets very complicated because sometimes they have additional coverage, right? They go back to work, they have a Florida Blue policy, but they still technically are enrolled in Medicaid. And so you then have a very difficult process of figuring out usually, you know, what's covered by what. And hospital services are going to be covered usually by the Blue policy, and then there are going to be some wraparound services covered by Medicaid. So that's something ACA, DCF really had to work through in it, but you're right. We're going back, you know, ultimately what we're looking at is going back to status quo ante.
Do you have a follow-up? Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about your community benefit reports and the amount of charity care. Does that number in either of those reports, does that come from the number of services you provide times your usual and customary charges, or does that come from the number of services and types of services times your average reimbursement from Medicare, private insurance, Medicaid for that service? How do you get to those two numbers?
You're recognized.
You want to take that, or you? I can give my stab. I'm not an expert on the preparation of those, and I'm sure there are a number of different ways, accounting being both an art and a science, of how you can present the numbers. With respect to my group, I know how we calculate our charity care for purposes of the low income pool has to do with a calculation based on what the actual cost of the procedure is, and looks exactly at what was done, and it's drawn from an audited cost report. And again, not all of my members file those community benefit reports because some of them are public, right? But the ones that do, it is associated with the charity care they provide, and there is a methodology, accepted methodologies of how they calculate the value of that charity care, as well as there's underinsurance potentially and some other things that they can do in the community that would also benefit the community that isn't associated with patient care. So there's a lot that goes into it, and I apologize. I can go back and try to get from my members a synopsis of that for you, but I don't have that as I sit here or stand here.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to offer to follow up with you on that. You know, it is the charity care. It's also bad debt, and then it's those other community improvement enhancement projects. And so my speculation is the charity care number is pretty well regulated by what's called the Form S-10, which is a form that all hospitals fill out. But we can get you more information on the methodology there.
Quick follow-up. Yep. So the average cost of a particular procedure will vary from hospital to hospital. I'm just curious. I see, you know, $2.9 billion in services, or $4.9 billion in charitable care and free services to individuals. But I also know that if it's a usual and customary charge, or if it's average cost, or it's particular cost of that particular, it's going to vary. And I'm trying to get my head wrapped around what that actual number is. So thank you. I appreciate if you could get back to me.
Sure.
Yeah, and I would just make it simple. I think maybe if I'm hearing it, is that calculated using sticker price or
right.
What people actually pay?
Understood.
Yeah, and I think that's because we all know that we see our EOBs and they're typically marked way down from sticker price.
Understood.
Okay, Whip Anderson, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I had a couple questions around specifically the public hospitals and the finances there. Part of it was answered with the chairman's question about profitability, and I think the answer was that some operate in the red and some are in the green. First part of that, is that accurate? And then second is what happens in these public hospitals when they are profitable? So where does that revenue go? How is it reinvested? Does it come back to the state? What happens with that?
You're recognized?
The money is generally going to go back and be reinvested in the community and in the hospital. They can use their operating revenue also to help fund things like the low-income pool. Overall, you are correct. There are some that have positive operating margins and some that have negative. An example of a negative would be usually Jackson Memorial has a negative, and Jackson Memorial runs a number of lines of business that are generally undesirable from a profitability standpoint. They are a Baker, they do it all. They're a Baker Act receiving facility. They have a burn center. They are a level one trauma center. They do solid organ transplants. They do bone marrow transplants. They do it for both adults and pediatrics. Maintaining, they're a RIPIC, a regional perinatal intensive care center. So maintaining all of those units and all of the things that you need to have those designations tends to throw them negative. And they break even as a result of the public health trust fund and taxes raised in the local community that helps offset the loss.
Follow?
Thank you, Chair. Can you shed a little bit of light of how these hospitals first came about? So what is the why is the government in the healthcare business here? I understand there's certain exceptions, right? So the VA is an example. It's a unique population set. We need to take care of our vets, but it looks like we have over 30 or so that are special districts or at least partially government funded, many of which are probably operating in the red. So there's a deficit there. What's the background, the mindset? Is there any plan to bring these hospitals more to the private sector?
Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Yeah. Ultimately, it seems like these were local decisions that have been made over the years to choose to have a public hospital and to make sure that there is a hospital in the area that handles some of the lines of business that no one else will handle. Because of the teaching mission and because of the public mission, the physicians and the types of units that maybe aren't in the community with the for-profit hospitals or the other hospitals will be at the public hospital, even though it's at a loss. And the result of that is that families can kind of stay in that community if they need something. An example would be pediatric solid organ transplants. In South Florida, all of the pediatric solid organ transplants are done at the public hospitals. There are no private hospitals that do them. And if they weren't there, ultimately people in South Florida would have to leave the region if their child needed a transplant. I think that's the reason behind it. When it comes to Miami, right, they formed a public health trust in 1973 under a permissive Florida statute that allows counties to do it, and made the decision to invest in that and make sure that people wouldn't have to leave the community if they had some of these kind of high need, high resource procedures or had a need for it. Does that answer your question?
You're welcome to ask a follow-up if you'd like.
Thank you, Chair. I think it does partially. I guess the overall concept is, you know, there's unique situations where I believe personally that it makes sense, and it is our job as the state to take care of certain portions of the population, of vulnerable people or unique groups. But when it comes to broad healthcare services, I disagree with that personally. You know, my different opinions, of course, are here. But I'm wondering, is there an overall strategy or plan to offload these hospitals to, you know, bring them to a point where they can be profitable and a private private institution would be interested in taking it over from the state completely?
You're right, Chair.
Ultimately, again, that comes down to a local decision. I can tell you, for example, that Tampa General used to be a public hospital and went private. I know that Lee Memorial right now, public hospital in Fort Myers, is exploring the possibility of going from being a public hospital to being a private. I don't think any of our other members, we have five additional public members in addition to Lee Health. None of the others are exploring it right now. Several of them are in a positive operating margin situation, and I think everyone has that goal. Some of the things that Jackson does would make it very difficult, as I explained, but some of the things even at Memorial and Broward make it difficult, but they do it in many years, right? So ultimately, it's kind of a local decision as to how the hospital should be structured and what the purpose is. Overall, I think you can expect your public hospital to see more Medicaid patients than the other hospitals, do more uninsured care than the other hospitals, and to maintain this really expensive public health infrastructure that's really important in an emergency or in a catastrophic event for everyone, regardless.
Last question.
No, I like your line of questions.
So when we have so most of these hospitals are in special districts, right? So that's its own self-contained unit, so to speak. If one is in a profitable district and another one is not profitable, is there any mechanism now where revenue can be shared? Can a profitable hospital share revenue with a one that's not profitable?
You're recognized.
As a general rule, I'm not really aware of that going on. Hospitals do work together, and certainly our members work together on certain things like charity care funding, on graduate medical education funding, and probably supply about a couple $1 billion total computable with the federal match, not just for our own members or helping our own members, but for all of the hospitals in the state potentially benefiting from it that do the work. I'm not aware of specific sharing. Sometimes that's a matter of, you know, your district happens to, you know, lower income folks are in your district and there's a wealthier patient mix in the district next to you, right? And that can have an impact because they're going to be more commercially paying patients in the district next to you. They're going to be more Medicare potentially if it's older. And so that can have an impact. And over time, there may be demographic changes that change it. The three that are kind of right next to each other that I know of are Broward Health, Memorial, and Jackson. And certainly Broward Health and Memorial do their best to have positive operating margins every year. They do a lot of this real expensive work and do the teaching mission that also is expensive. But they do try to have positive operating margins. So does Jackson, although it's very difficult given the profile of the patients they take in and the units that they run.
Thank you.
I have a government hospital in my county, and it's just like all the other ones. It just happens to be owned by the government. They don't do anything special. So, and they're not, you know, no one goes from other parts of the county to that hospital because they need the safety net. It just happens to be the hospital, and it's been around forever. That's sort of kind of getting at your question. Okay, let's see. Were you done?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. My question is along the lines of Rep. Woodson's in the higher rate of former Medicaid recipients coming to the ER, but with a twist in terms of what the hospital systems might be doing to point those individuals toward primary care. So understanding that some may be able to check their Medicaid eligibility, re-enroll them, but if they're not eligible, what's the pathway to the marketplace or an FQHC or a clinic or something like that where they could receive primary care and not the more expensive ED care?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our members would try to direct people to the resources that can help them, and they have people on staff that are trying to get them connected with healthcare. We have two members as well in Broward County that run a health plan, and it is a Medicaid health plan. And in addition to that, they actually have a care management and care coordination program that is for the uninsured. So they will handle that uninsured patient and try to make sure that the discharge process is smooth for them, get them connected with a federally qualified health center, something of that nature. And a lot of our members have those types of connections with federally qualified health centers in their area. And they also take people on a sliding scale, and regardless of their ability to pay, to get them connected with potentially mental health care, dental care, as well as primary care. And so it is an effort. You know, ultimately, our hospitals tend to be systems. And so as systems of care that own other types of facilities and control other types of facilities, we try to make sure that the uninsured are in a system that is helpful to them at all times.
Follow-up, or are you good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you have a response as well?
I'm sorry, ranking member.
You know, certainly we share a member that runs an indigent clinic in their community as part of their community benefit package. There's also counseling for those that have come off Medicaid that might be above the 100% of the federal poverty level threshold. There are navigators for the federal exchange where these people are hopefully eligible for subsidies and so forth. And so part of the community benefit our hospitals provide is ensuring there's a warm, not ensuring, but looking for warm handoffs, ways to maintain care, and so forth.
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you. We had our presentation in healthcare appropriations yesterday, and I wasn't able to ask this question of ACA because of time limits. So from the hospital perspective, the requirements of Senate Bill 1718 of doing the head count, patients come in through your hospital systems. What is the experience so far? How is that information being transferred to ACA? And is it how's it going?
That's the bill regarding immigration status?
Yes, yeah. The immigration status headcount. Yeah.
Mr. Chair. You're recognized.
Yeah, our members have been gathering the information under four categories, which is U.S. citizen legally in the United States, not a U.S. citizen legally in the United States, not legally present in the United States, and then the people who refuse to answer. Most people are responding to it, including they get some responses that say that they're not legally in the United States, and all of this information, I believe, will be reported to ACA at the end of the month, I think, is the first reporting requirement. The overwhelming majority of people are legally residing in the United States. We have some members down in the Miami area that have a lot of people who are not U.S. citizens who are legally residing in the United States in response. But the people who are saying that they're not here legally, they actually do answer the question rather than refuse, and it's a relatively low percentage.
Okay. Okay, great. Four more folks with questions. Representative Amnesty, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question in regards to the safety net hospitals listed. Are they all under, do they fall under the jurisdiction of 501c3 IRS status, or is there any other ruling that they would fall under?
You're recognized.
Yeah, eight of them are 501c3 nonprofit, and six are public entities.
Okay.
Follow-up, if yep. I may. And then the other question that I have, I see here that most of them, if not all, offer the transplant unit. What is the current or the average wait time for a patient to receive a transplant currently in the state of Florida?
Either, if you know.
Yeah, I apologize. I can try to get you that data. Ultimately, when we say transplant unit, some of them do kidneys, some of them do kidneys, lungs, and Jackson does everything, including multivisceral, for both pediatric and adult. So there's a lot of different types. Those are solid organ transplants. We also have additional members that do bone marrow transplants, and there are a lot of hospitals, other hospitals around the state, not in our membership, that do bone marrow transplants as well. I can try to get you more data on that.
Thank you.
Long way of saying that.
Thank you.
Good. All right. Representative Hart, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe I heard you say that Tampa General went private. Can you tell me a little bit about what the impact is now that they've gone private? Do they still see as many indigent patients as before?
You're recognized.
Yeah, ultimately they do. And that is an arrangement. As a company goes from being a publicly owned to being a private hospital, there still was a lot of discussion between the county and Tampa General about what that transition would look like and how it would look on the other side. And there still are a lot of commitments at Tampa General to serve the public interest and to make sure that they are a true safety net hospital. And they train an enormous number of the next generation of physicians with their relationship with the University of South Florida. They do an extensive number of transplants, and ultimately some Tampa General days you'll see some of the transplant patients up here. I mean, they do an extraordinary job with it. So yes, and they have very high Medicaid and high charity numbers, and they also still, through an arrangement with Hillsborough County, help fund the low-income pool and things like that. So that's ultimately the structure of how you arrange going from private to public, which is something, as I said before, Lee Health is considering right now.
And we had to pass a bill to do that. I'll just one example. In my county, we had a nonprofit sell to a for-profit, and all the sort of money they made got put into the Brevard County Health Foundation, and they supposedly, you know, use that money to do good. They also built a really nice building with it. But you know, that's what happens with the excess proceeds in those situations. Are you good? Okay, Representative Edmonds, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question may be a little bit off topic, but the biggest issues in my county with hospitals is the staffing shortage. What are we doing to reduce or increase staff in our hospitals?
You're recognized.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a real challenge for hospitals all over the state and I think all over the country. We probably went into the pandemic with a little bit of a nursing shortage in the country, and the nursing shortage became exacerbated by COVID because we had a lot of retirements and a lot of people burning out and leaving the industry. Ultimately, that has raised the cost of labor for all hospitals in the state of Florida. Labor costs, hospitals during the emergency were spending a large amount of money on traveling nurses, significantly higher than their normal costs. That has kind of calmed down, but we're now at a new normal in terms of labor costs that is higher, and every hospital in the country is facing that challenge. And I can say, it's not just us, it's every healthcare facility is facing it. We're not the only ones that employ nurses. We're not the only ones that employ physicians. So it's a challenge that everybody is working through, and it's definitely something that everyone has felt, and that's probably when you see the year over year, yes, the hospital industry in Florida has a positive operating margin. Year over year, it's been squeezed. That is probably the primary source of the squeeze.
Okay. You're recognized.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, so I would just go ahead and add. At its peak, our hospital staff vacancy was somewhere around 22-23%. We've reduced that to 13%, which still puts it at about 25-year high, but it's much closer to where the high used to be than that exorbitant number. Hospitals have responded to the move towards contract staffing by, you know, increasing wages, adding overtime, up-training their staff. And so they've done a lot of work to make sure that they're creating an environment to maintain their workforce. It's critical that your nursing staff is full-time employees and not contract if you can avoid it, because there is a culture that a hospital needs to cultivate that can't be done in 180-day or 90-day stretches.
Can I just add, that crisis is going to take some time. Ultimately, you can't produce nurses necessarily overnight. There has been some funding in the state of Florida from the legislature that is put toward the creation of more nurses, because it doesn't just happen at the hospital, right? It has to happen with the community colleges and with the four-year universities and in master's programs. And you have to have the faculty and the infrastructure in place to increase the number of students, so it does take some time. There has been some investment in the state of Florida, some pretty significant investment in the last couple of years, but it will take time for that to work through. Our hospitals also have relationships generally with, you know, the Memorial and Broward would have relationships with Broward College, Miami-Dade College in Jackson. I know that HCA has relationships with nursing schools, right? I mean, ultimately, we're all kind of trying to work toward more nursing education and trying to alleviate this this issue. But it will take time.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Yep, you're recognized. Go ahead.
What does the future of artificial intelligence look like in the hospitals, and could that help supplement any staffing shortages, and is it going to increase any life expectancies in our state?
You're recognized.
Only time will tell. Thank you. Only time will tell. I mean, I think that there are going to be opportunities there in terms of diagnostics. I think there's going to be opportunities there in terms of monitoring and remote patient monitoring. There's going to be all sorts of opportunities there that we have to work through. And I would imagine there are going to be solutions that none of us have even thought of yet that are going to come forward if this country's history is any guide to the future.
Representative Masullo is planning on filing a bill to give them scope of practice, and they can just start
making robots
decisions on their own. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Cross. Sorry. Go ahead.
So, you know, directly responding to your question, is it going to help staffing, right? So currently, you know, you got dozens, if not hundreds of companies looking at healthcare and AI. One of the interesting things our hospitals have been focused on is where AI might supplement, you know, a physician sees a patient and has to go insert their notes, which, you know, that takes time away from access to care. So you've got a Siri-type device that's taking notes for the physician in real time. It means they can look at the patient instead of sit at a computer and type. So there are hopefully going to be benefits, you know, if not supplementing staff, assisting staff burnout is another possibility for AI in the hospital setting. There are going to be clinical decision support tools, which opens a whole other, you know, box of worms. It's certainly a focus for our members.
Okay. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for your presentations. I've seen some things come out recently that we're seeing closures or risk of closures in some of our rural areas. And I was just hoping that you could comment on that and what we can do as a state to prevent that.
You recognize so hospital closures in rural areas.
Yeah, we do have a couple of rural hospitals that are in our membership in the Panhandle. There's a lot of challenges around being a rural hospital. What we've seen, we have seen around the country some closures of rural hospitals. We've seen closures of pediatric facilities, maternity units, as well as mental health units. Those are all kind of Medicaid-heavy, low-margin type of things, and rural communities. It's a real challenge. As far as Medicaid goes, it's hard necessarily to solve the problems in healthcare using the Medicaid program because Medicaid is a very small percentage of hospital revenue and a very small percentage of the budget. Anything that could be done to kind of ease the regulatory burden on those hospitals from a state perspective would probably help. Looking at ways to work with the federal government on that would help as well. But that's a very comprehensive question. I think it requires a broad solution. I'm sorry, I'm not necessarily have one from the podium.
Yes. To his point, there's no panacea to fix this. I think first of all, you know, thanks to our legislature last year for appropriating funds for capital improvement programs for rural hospitals, something we'd like to see again this year. And I'm sure we'll be talking with many of you about it. Beyond that, there's a federal program that was implemented last year called the Rural Emergency Hospital. It sort of changes the way rural hospitals function. It actually takes away their inpatient function, but allows them to continue operating an outpatient setting with an emergency room. They're reimbursed differently. They receive costs plus 5%, as well as, you know, a monthly stipend. That's got to see some changes at the state level as well, but it's an idea, right? And I think... those are two small pieces of the puzzle to help stem some of the issues we're dealing with at the rural level.
Good. Okay. Anyone who hasn't asked a question yet want to? Yeah. Vice Chair Barrero.
Thank you, Chairman. So just changing a little bit of the topic over here, one of my frustrations is a situation which I think is very prevalent at hospitals, urgent care centers, where patients go to get services and they really don't have any opportunity to kind of shop around. I know that we've attempted to tackle the issues with surprise medical billing, balance billing, where, you know, patients get caught with the difference between what the cost is for the service and then what the insurance company reimburses the hospital for. And it just happens so often where a patient will go in and the physician will say, this is what we're going to prescribe you, A, B, and C. And there's no opportunity to review what the prices are. There's no opportunity to kind of shop around. It's just, this is what your bill is. This is what your services are going to be provided for. And then there's really no information that's provided to the patient with what that's going to cost him. There's really no even an attempt to provide what those costs will be to the patient or for the insurance company. So my question is there anything that is being done or that you can suggest to, you know, to really fix this issue? I know the federal government tried to tackle it with the No Surprises Act. We've tried to tackle that through the Florida legislature in the past, but it still seems to be that this issue is very prevalent. So is there anything that you can recommend or that you see to sort of help to resolve that issue?
You recognize.
Mr. Thank you. Excellent question. Our hospitals, as public hospitals and as hospitals affiliated with public universities, actually, we're very transparent with our prices. If you went on, for example, Memorial's website in Broward, you could actually put in your insurance and you could actually also say your private pay, and they would give you the price that they would charge you for, or what the bill would be for a number of different shoppable services. There is a federal regulation that, you know, if you've had a stroke or you've been in a car accident you've had some sort of accident, you're not in a position to shop, but there are a lot of services that are performed at the hospital that are so-called shoppable. And the federal government does require hospitals now to put out the prices that they have for 300 shoppable services. The hospital industry over the last couple of years has been coming into compliance with it. Ultimately, I think what we've got to do is we've got to get to a point where patients really have usable information, right? And so when they go in to a hospital or they're planning a procedure, because that's really when you get to shop, is if you're planning a hip replacement or a knee replacement, that they actually have information about what various hospitals in their community charge and that they know what their out-of-pocket is. And I would say one of the entities that would know that would be the health plan itself. Your health plan would know what they pay for a hip replacement at Hospital X, Hospital Y, and Hospital Z, and could tell you that. They could also tell you you're out of pocket, right, and what it's likely to be. But you do have to get away, I think. I mean, and with these shoppable services, we have gotten away from, you know, you pay for every little thing that gets done and more, there's a bundled payment associated with this shoppable service. I can tell you in the state of Florida as well, we do have a website where the hospitals do say what the commercial payers pay them for these procedures. And you can go online and compare and look. But I think, you know, I don't know whether these tools are really used that much because patients really care about what their out-of-pocket is. And they really want to know exactly what it's going to cost them out-of-pocket. So, you know, we got to kind of, as a state, I think, tighten that up and make the information usable and actionable. I will also say, I talked about quality earlier, not everybody is looking for a low bidder hip replacement, right? I mean, ultimately, there is an element of quality here that people need to keep in mind, and that also has to be part of the shopping equation.
No, the experience with the federal regulation on transparency has been illustrative in the fact that this is not easy. They put out that regulation in 2020. They've put in new iterations and subsequent rulemaking almost once a year. This latest rulemaking, you know, sort of said, this is tough. And we've tried to figure it out this way, and we haven't, and this way, and we haven't. So now we're going to standardize things and hope that helps. I think patient awareness is probably incredibly key here, right? I'd have to imagine most people don't understand that they could go onto a hospital's website and find these shoppable services when they can shop for services, as Justin noted. And so I think it's as much a challenge to make sure that the patient understands that the hospitals are there for them, they have those prices for them at their website, at the ready. And then there is challenges between figuring out, you know, what's the patient's out-of-pocket, which we believe is the most critical point here, and straight lining that up with the insurance plan where you have, you know, dozens of insurance carriers that might have, you know, dozens of individual plans themselves. And so it's not as simple as saying, I'm Florida Blue PPO and I want this service, this is what I'm getting. It's I'm Florida Blue PPO, this is my deductible, this is what I've already paid out of pocket, so on and so forth. And
And so there are a lot of challenges there, but I think, you know, it's important that hospitals have led the way on this transparency, and I think the more awareness out there on the patient community, the better.
Short on time. We'll do, three of you want to have a second bite of the apple, and I've got a couple more questions. But Representative Grant?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question or a follow-up to your previous answer about quality. So based on that answer, I'm guessing you are an advocate of the patient culture survey?
I'm sorry, I was an advocate for what? I didn't hear what you said.
The patient culture survey that
the
legislature passed.
Yep, you're recognized.
Yeah. Actually, I think we did work with the sponsor on that and helped get that across the line. I think we waved in support of it, if I'm not mistaken. Okay.
Anything else?
We're certainly in support of cultures of safety. The survey, might need work, but we appreciate the sentiment behind the idea.
Representative Woodson, for a brief second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I really appreciate it. My question has to do with the trend that Justin mentioned, the trend that you are seeing from from nonprofit moving for-profit hospital. And Webb Hart touched it a little bit when she mentioned Tampa Hospital. But my question to you, what do you see as the pros and the cons of those hospitals moving from nonprofit to for-profit? And I'm more concerned about the cons because we want Florida to be healthy. We want more people to have access to affordable care, to be able to go to a hospital. And if we're seeing a lot of hospitals moving, I'm not saying a lot now, but that's the trend. So what do you see as the pros and the cons, and what can we do to alleviate whatever issues that can
You're recognized.
Address the issues?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
To clarify, I wouldn't say it's a trend. Tampa General did it a couple decades ago, and we haven't had one do it since. And Lee is exploring it. I don't know what ultimately the conclusion is going to be for Lee Health. So I wouldn't necessarily call it a trend. The other is that they went from a public status to a not-for-profit status at Tampa General, which is also, I believe, what Lee is exploring. So they didn't go from a public to a for-profit status. And ultimately, it does come down to, in terms of the concern for public health, and I'm sure Lee County will get very involved in this, and Hillsborough County got very involved in it, it involves commitments from the hospital around its locations, around the investments that are going to be made, and making sure that when Tampa General got to the other side of that conversion, that they still saw a high percentage of Medicaid patients and had a commitment to continue doing so, that they still saw a high percentage of uninsured and had a commitment to doing so, and that they still had a commitment to do their teaching mission, to have their transplant units, to have their RIPIC, and do all the things that they do there. And ultimately, Lee's going to have to go through that process. I don't think one hospital 20 years ago makes a trend, and Lee is exploring it now, and it's going to come down to how Lee County and the people of Lee County work that and get to the other side if that's where they choose to go. That's going to be a commitment from Lee Health to see the uninsured, to see the patients, to maintain Golisano Children's Hospital, to maintain its RIPIC, right, to maintain its Level 2 Trauma Center, right, the things that they do. Ultimately, that's going to be part of that process.
Okay. All right. Ranking Member Skidmore for a quick follow-up.
Thank you. Real quick. Over the summer, I didn't feel well and decided to take myself to the ER because of a previous heart attack. And it turns out my blood pressure had skyrocketed. It was 210 over 100. And so they were like, yeah, you got to come in. We're going to admit you. There were 8 psych holds on the floor when I got admitted. There were no rooms. So I was going to have to stay overnight in the ED with 8 psych holds. And it seems like it's a very common thing that's happening in our hospitals, and we don't seem to have a great answer. But I'm curious if it's happening just in my district or if that's happening around the state where mental health is kind of taking over, if you will, the ED departments and the resources there, and what do you see as a solution?
You're recognized? Whoever wants to go for it?
There's... there's definitely some seasonality that we've seen to COVID in particular in this state. And so there are going to be times of year where the hospitals, it seems like in the last 3 years anyway, have been very much slammed. In Florida, that season seems to really peak between the second half of July and the first half of September. And there are also RSV can rear its head in the state of Florida at that time. So you definitely can get times a year where you're going to get very busy at the hospital. Our hospitals are committed to having the capacity at all times, right? And sometimes that leads to vacancies because you have to have the capacity if there is an emergency or if there is a surge. And so there might be some times that are quote unquote, or at least relatively quieter, where you don't have that type of patient load. I don't know the specifics of what was going on. I assume it was Palm Beach County. I don't know the specifics of what was going on there or what time of year. I did not hear of that happening this year at our facilities. It certainly was occurring in 2020, 2021, and 2022, particularly toward the end of the summer. We're very lucky in a couple of those years that we didn't get hit by a hurricane at the same time that was happening, to be perfectly blunt. But I don't know what happened in that specific situation.
Yeah, and I'm not going to give this answer the justice it deserves, but, you know, if there's that many behavioral health patients in an emergency room, then there's likely been issues down the line that we've got to address. I mean, it is community-based health. It's funding FACT teams. It's ensuring there is follow-up care and making sure patients are taking their medicine. It is ensuring that we're monitoring the number of behavioral health patients that you know, are able to stay and work, readmissions for behavioral health, things like that. We know it works. We know, you know, Tampa Bay Thrives, I believe is the name of the program, is a highly successful community-based behavioral health care program. And so as we, you know, talk about behavioral health, it's got to be the full continuum of care and with the goal to keep patients out of the emergency room.
Thank you. I have one final question, and then I know I'm the only thing standing in between everyone going home, so I'll make this quick. I was a question to Mr. Senior. You said that in your group of 14 safety net hospitals, 8 are nonprofit and 6 are government. Why can't they all be nonprofit? Why do they inherently have to be government?
I don't know that there's necessarily an ironclad reason why. Ultimately, the communities, particularly in South Florida, have chosen to have hospitals that that have a public structure and that to have whether it's a board appointed by the governor or whether it is an accountable board elected and controlled by the county commission. It's a decision that has been made in those communities.
But you don't have to be a government hospital to be a safety net hospital.
No, we have 8 members that are not government hospitals.
All right. Well, thank you guys for being here, and thanks for your presentation today. Thank you, members, for staying on Thursday. And with that, Vice Chair Barrero moves we rise. With that, we are adjourned.